Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. Today we have a super special guest, my good friend and colleague Charlotte Dennett, who is the author of a must-read new book titled The Crash of Flight 3804, A Lost Spy, A Daughter's Quest, and The Deadly Politics of the Great Game for Oil. Now, I think this book is one of the most important connect-the-dots historical accounts of what's known as the Great Game for Oil that has ever been written. And I'm not just saying that because Charlotte's my friend. I'm saying it because it's true. Now, the reasons why it would take someone like her to write this book. First of all, she has family skin in the game. Her father, Daniel Dennett, was America's first master spy in the Middle East. And he died in a strange plane crash, Flight 3804, in Ethiopia, with, among other people, the American oil attaché. Charlotte is an extremely persistent investigative reporter, which is why she spent decades looking into his death, and along the way uncovered the long, bloody, vicious history of competition for oil among nations, ours chief among them. She's lived and reported from the Middle East, Lebanon to be precise, and she's a lawyer, which gave her the tools she needed to sue the CIA in an effort to pry information about her father's death from them. Since enormous amounts of our tax dollars and the blood of our citizens have been and are still being spent on the Great Game for Oil, I'd say we all have skin in this game, which is the biggest reason why everyone should read her book and hear what she has to say. Welcome, Charlotte.
Christina, what an introduction. Who could
ask
for more?
Let's get right to it, because this is a big book. This is a big book, and we only have one little hour.
So this is a very important day for me because this is the official pub date, April 2nd. Who would have guessed that after all this work, my book would come out while everyone is besieged by pandemic? But all the more reason why I'm thankful that I have the opportunity to talk with you about the book.
Well, listen, all the more reason, too, for them all to go to Amazon. They don't have anything better to do. Go to Amazon and order your book and read it since they don't have anything better to do.
Well, yeah, except I'm not sure Amazon is still shipping books. I think it is. They can also get the book through Chelsea Green, my publisher, and it's also an e-book. So
well, if you
one way or the
Chelsea
other.
Green, what's the website? Is it chelseagreen.com?
Or yeah, something? Yeah.
What is?
That's
okay.
It. Chelseagreen. I think it's .com. And
all
it'll
right,
be there under new releases. Anyway.
Let's dive right into this.
Yes.
I want you to set the scene about how you got into, you know, how you got looking into your father's death and how that led you to connecting these dots about the biggest, most secret operations in the world connected to the multinational fight for the planet's oil reserves.
How I got started. I think it was when I was a reporter in Lebanon and the Middle East in 1975. And the Lebanese Civil War broke out that year. It would last 15 years. Of course, I wouldn't know it. And exactly 45 years ago, April 1st, I went on a vacation to Europe. But shortly afterwards, while I was abroad, a busload of Palestinians was fired on. And I knew that was going to be a spark that started a bigger conflagration because I had been shot at about 2 weeks previous in what seems to have been the prelude to the Civil War. Anyway, to cut to the chase, I ended up going back to New York for a while, and to Massachusetts, where my brother lives, and thinking that I would, sit it out for a while. I really did not think I wanted to get killed in a civil war that I couldn't even understand. And that's when I started thinking about, hey, wait a minute, and I've spent these couple of years traveling all over the Middle East, and I seem to be following the footsteps of my father. So I never knew him, by the way. That's a big factor. I was 6 weeks old when he died.
Oh, wow.
So this was partly a way of understanding who he was, and because I knew he was a spy all along, but because he was a very high-level spy in the Middle East, I thought trying to figure out his life would be an interesting task. And the thing that really kicked it off, I was visiting my brother's house, who also has the name Dan Dennett, by the way, and after telling them about all my travels in the Middle East, I recalled that there was a trunk full of something up in the attic. I knew it had something to do with the Middle East. My grandmother was once taught in Turkey, and the trunk was like covered with all her exotic costumes. And I had seen it once before as a little kid. But this time, during my visit to my brother's house, and this would have been 1975, I went up to the trunk, I found it, I opened it, and it was full of scrapbooks. And in the scrapbooks were letters home from my father and from my mother. Some were when he first went to the Middle East in the 30s to teach at the American University of Beirut, and others that were written while he was stationed in Beirut with the cover of cultural attaché for the State Department. But in fact, he was a major counterintelligence spy for the Office of Strategic Services and the Central Intelligence Group. And when I started to go through his letters, it started to blow my mind. I found his last letter home, and I found his last report home. And when I read through them, it was all about a secret mission to Saudi Arabia. And when I read through those letters, I thought, wow, this is big. His last mission was to chart the course of the Trans-Arabian Pipeline that was going to carry the precious oil of Saudi Arabia over the desert to a terminal point on the eastern Mediterranean. And it was either going to be, get this, Palestine or Lebanon.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah. And then it was going to be transshipped to Europe, and it was very important for the reconstruction of Europe after the war. And it was when I read through his last report, I saw that there was all sorts of intrigue around the route of the pipeline. And at this particular time, it was not only whether the pipeline would terminate in Palestine, which was then racked with fighting between Jews, Arabs, and the British, but also that the pipeline either way was going to have to pass through Syria. And the Syrian president, Kuwaitli, was resisting the pipeline going through Syria. And part of the reason for his resistance was his opposition to the United States' growing support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. So I realized right there my father was smack in the middle of the Middle East conflict and it had a lot to do with oil. That's a long answer to your question.
Well, I mean, what that does, though, is it really opens the door. First of all, I just want to talk a little bit more about your dad. You thought it was a suspicious airplane crash, right?
Yes, I did.
Why?
Well, one of the things that I found in the scrapbook was the obituary. it must have been written by my grandfather and grandmother. I mean, they knew him. But how it was written, I thought, was a bit misleading. It said he was on a vacation junket, for one thing. And his last letters home and his last report shows that it was definitely not a vacation junket. Another thing I thought was very interesting is the obituary just mentioned that it had a big load of freight on the plane and that it crashed into the side of the mountain, but it didn't say anything about where my father had come from, which was Saudi Arabia. That whole part of the story was missing. It just looked like, you know, it was an accident, unfortunate. There were five other people on the plane, and that was it. And I knew otherwise because I had his last report. So that's why I thought it was suspicious right from the start. Why would they conceal some very important facts? Well, it was obvious. The facts had to do with oil. The other thing is I later found out that the heavy load was top secret communications equipment that was destined for Ethiopia at a time when Emperor Haile Selassie was trying to rid himself of the British yoke. The British controlled everything in Ethiopia, all outside communications, all railroad communications, the military, everything. And the Americans were trying to get in there. And first of all, they were able to get a exclusive oil concession with Sinclair Oil, which upset the British very much. And then here they were also trying to set up an airlines, which would become Ethiopian Airlines, controlled by the government but managed initially by TWA. TWA, how does that ring with you, Christina?
Yeah, right.
Anyway, that's part of the answer.
So, you know, the thing about this book that is so amazing is how you talk about all these wars were oil wars. Like you say, World War One was an oil war, right?
I do.
And you say World War Two was an oil war. So could you talk about those two wars as oil wars? How did you come to that? You know, talk about the history that makes that clear to you.
Wow, that's a question that requires a big answer. I'll try to do my best. I found out about the importance of oil in World War One, by, believe it or not, tracing back to what the hell was my grandmother doing in Istanbul in 1900. That was the origin of our family's interest in the Middle East. She was sent there as a congregational missionary from Winchester, Massachusetts. She went to Smith College. And at the time, it was one of the few outlets that women had. They could be missionaries or missionary educators. So I knew she had taught there, but I didn't know very much more than that. And I didn't know the missionary connection, which is really interesting because I spent 18 years working on a book with my husband about how missionaries were used in Latin America by large corporate interests to gain access to indigenous lands. But here I am discovering that my grandmother was a missionary over there. So then I eventually began to find out that around the time she was posted there, 1900, was when the U.S. was first penetrating the Middle East, and it was through Turkey, because Turkey was sort of the crossroads between Europe and Asia. Anyway, while I was researching her, and her work at, it was called the American College of Girls, I got into the archives, which are in New York, and while I was waiting for a box of files, I discovered a book in the bookshelf at these archives. The name of it was The Berlin to Baghdad Railway, and I thought, what is this book doing in a missionary library? And when I started to read the book, it was one of those aha moments, because what it described was a growing concern, especially by the English, but also other large powers, that the Germans were penetrating the Middle East. They were going to build a railroad that would go from Berlin. It would pass through Turkey, which is where my grandmother was, and then it was headed right towards Iraq and Iran. Now, the Brits had big oil reserves, had just found them in Iran. And this is a time when oil is beginning to capture attention as a fuel. By 1911, Winston Churchill, who was then First Lord of the Admiralty, decided that he would have to convert the fuel for the British Navy from coal to oil. And England had plenty of coal. It did not have oil. And so he knew when he made that decision that Britain would have to, quote, fight on a sea of troubles to get oil. One of the prize victories for the British was the oil of Iraq. They called it a first-class war aim. So while we are all mostly focusing on the ground war that is happening in Europe, the war in the Middle East, which is less well-known, was ultimately the efforts of the British to get control over the vast oil reserves of Iraq. And the whole story about the struggles in Palestine, for instance, and Lawrence of Arabia. You know, Lawrence of Arabia, his job was to get the Arabs on the side of the British to kick the Turks out of the Middle East. And that's the other point why Turkey was so important. It used to be the headquarters of a vast overseas empire, the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
So anyway, their job, they got the Brits to kick the Turks out, and they made promises to the Arabs afterwards that they would have independence. And those promises were broken. And later on, to add insult to injury, in 1917, the British created the Balfour Declaration, which acknowledged a Jewish home in Palestine. And we're off and running with the Middle East conflict at that point. By the way, the Jews get later screwed in World War II. So the World War II aspect is that in 1943, when the U.S. knew about the Holocaust, there was a clamoring to even bomb Auschwitz so that it would stop the killing machines. And
right.
I remember talking to somebody who had been in Auschwitz who verified. He said, when we heard the planes going ahead, we shouted, bomb us, bomb us. But they didn't. And if they had bombed Auschwitz, it would have stopped the killing machines. And some of the refugees, or some of the people inside the camp, would be able to escape to Palestine. There was a problem, though. And, you know, I've got the documents to show it. One of the main people who opposed having Jews going to Palestine was King Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia. He didn't want it. He was regarded as a leader of the Arab world, and he was very much opposed to establishing a Jewish home in Palestine. There's reasons beyond anti-Semitism, of which there was plenty, that
like
he opposed.
What?
He saw it as a colonial outpost, okay? So he said,
uh-huh,
if you do that, your oil concession in Arabia will be affected. So he was constantly threatening, and that created a huge problem for Roosevelt. He was trying to figure a way to get around this, and one at one point even proposed to Ibn Saud that he be the leader of Palestine if he would allow more Jews in. Anyway, that's kind of a long-winded story of an oil connection to World War II.
Well, it's so, you know, what's so interesting is, like, the ignoring of killings comes all the way up to now with Khashoggi being chopped up in the Turkish consulate or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that was
we don't do anything because, and at least Trump is very open about it, saying, well, we've got all these deals with the Saudis. You know, it's so interesting how obviously the connection of the Jewish Holocaust to, you know, the fact that it was allowed to keep going and so on, is connected to, you know, our wanting oil concessions. A lot of people don't know, but they don't know anything about the Armenian Holocaust and its connection. Could you talk about the Armenian Holocaust?
Yeah, that's another tragedy, and I was able to get into it as well because I know I have letters, or not letters, but yes, documents that show that my grandmother taught Armenian orphans, and some of the missionaries would sew clothes for them, and yet it was never discussed in my household.
Why?
My grandmother never told me about the genocide, and I think the reason is shame.
Oh.
Absolute shame, because they were sold out too. During when the big powers were trying to determine as they said, carve up the turkey. How do you like that? The Ottoman Empire. At one point, there was a promise to create an Armenia, and the reason was that the Western powers had used the plight of the Armenians to get the U.S. into World War I. Save the Armenians! Save the Armenians! They said. Now, why were they saying it? Because the Turkey was slaughtering Armenians and forcing them out of portions of Turkey, which I have found happens to coincide with the route of the railway, the Berlin to Baghdad railway. And in fact, later on,
They were clearing out Armenians for the Berlin to Baghdad railway?
It cleaned them out. They were put, some of them were used to work on the railroads, and others were transported on the railway out of their homeland, which is part of Turkey, where they were well concentrated. They were also hated because they were a lot of the Armenians were well educated, and they had thriving businesses. But they got caught up in the great game because sometimes the Russians, who were Christian, tried to use the Armenians to fight the Turks, and some of that was going on as well. But anyway, so these horrendous attacks occurred both during even before World War I broke out. A lot of the Armenians did escape to Lebanon, and I remember very distinctly when I was there in 1975, and would drive past their refugee camps, these tin hovels.
Armenian refugee camps.
Well, they were, because they'd been thrown out of their home. Where are they going to settle? They settled in Lebanon. And it was, I mean, the conditions in the camp were appalling. There was an unforgettable odor that came from the camps. It was just because these people were not well cared for. Of course, Lebanon has become a refuge for the Palestinians, later on, and that would be a huge aspect of the Civil War, was to get the Palestinians out of Lebanon, and it succeeded to a certain degree. Anyway, this is just tragedy upon tragedy upon tragedy, and a lot of it has been hidden from the American people. Certainly the oil connection is hidden, and I suspect that the reason for it is quote-unquote national security reasons. But now it's so open, so out in the open. I mean, yeah, Trump not being skilled as one would think, in the arts of double speak and confusion when it comes to big power contests. He was very blunt about what was going on in the war in Syria. You know, like, we're going to take the oil, he says.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's not our oil, for heaven's sakes. And the thing that gets to me is the people in the Middle East all know. They know it's about oil, and I have plenty of quotes in the book. You know, in Afghanistan, it was about oil and gas. And there's some quotes from some excellent journalists who have the people saying, we know why they're here. It's not about us. It's not about democracy. It's because they want the oil. In the case of Afghanistan, Afghanistan was and remains a crucial transshipment location for gas from the Caspian Sea, specifically Turkmenistan, which borders Afghanistan. And there's been in the works a pipeline in Afghanistan called TAPI, T-A-P-I, and that stands for Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. So those are the countries that the pipeline was supposed to go through. And that's why the U.S. got involved, to protect that pipeline. And for a while they used the Taliban. The U.S. used the Taliban because they were the fiercest warriors, and they kept other warriors away. So the whole idea was protect that pipeline and carry some of the riches from the Caspian Sea, which is very rich in natural gas. Here I am going on.
Well, I'm listening to this, and I remember seeing a map showing how right now all the military bases and outposts, American military, are along that route, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's the thing. The military are in there to protect the pipeline. I mean, they're also there. They're along the border of Pakistan because a lot of the Taliban recruited their fighters from refugees of the Afghan War, which, of course, the U.S. was involved in, and used the Taliban and used jihadists. That's another element of it. The elements to consider, why are the military there? They're there to protect oil and gas routes or reserves. When you look all over the Middle East, I've got 12 maps there, and each map shows the route of pipelines and where the military outposts are. It all becomes very clear when you look at the maps. It's like they tell a thousand words.
Yep. Now we're going to go a little third rail here, but, or maybe not, I don't know. Talk about 9/11 and how
9/11. I'll tell you something. It is third rail, and but here's what I can say, without getting all the specifics, even the forensics. Okay.
Yeah.
My goal is to reveal a hidden history, and how it impacts on a region, and how it impacts on our lives. What I show in the book is that the idea of invading Iraq had germinated in the minds of the neoconservatives long before 9/11, in which first of all, Afghanistan was attacked by U.S. troops, and 2 years later, Iraq. Both countries, and specifically Iraq, were on the drawing board by Cheney long before 9/11. There was, in 1997, there was a project for a new American century. And let's put this in context. The dissolution of the Soviet Union was huge because former so-called Soviet republics had gone independent. And the West moved in with a vengeance and started wooing them. And one of the main prizes at that time was the oil and gas of the Caspian Sea. So right. What I'm saying is Cheney set up, an energy task force, and they had literally mapped out where all the oil of Iraq was.
Well, and that was in early 2001, right?
Yes, it was. That was early 2001. Yep.
It was called the National Energy Policy Development Group,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
early
I
think it was 9 months before September 11. And then in the weeks just weeks following, Wesley Clark, who was a NATO commander, had a meeting with a Pentagon official. He later describes it in his book. And the Pentagon told him that seven countries were going to be essentially conquered in 5 years. That was
right.
The plan. And they were Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. And then when you see what's happening, they've certainly tried, but the West, the United States, let's say the United States especially, but NATO countries, have made a mess in those countries. They haven't
Have they made a mess that is to their benefit, do you think? I mean, I find it interesting, for example, like Netanyahu made two comments around the time of the Iraq war and maybe a little before, I'm not sure, but, you know, he said two things. He said 9/11 was very good for Israel, and he said, you know, soon you'll see Iraq oil going to Haifa.
Yeah, and that was the angle that I zeroed in on. I can't remember how I found it, but when the Iraq war started, and this is the second one under W.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I just sort of logically started looking for pipelines. Because I had, at that point, I had developed what I call a pipeline consciousness, and I had become a pipeline tracker. And lo and behold, there it was. That and the quotes come right out of the Israeli press, where Netanyahu, he was then finance minister in 2003, and he brags about how soon the oil will be flowing from Iraq to Haifa. Well, what he was talking about was reopening a pipeline that had been built in the 1930s, connecting the oil of Iraq to what was then Palestine. And one branch went to British-controlled Palestine, and the northern branch went to French-controlled Syria. These were one of the outcomes of World War I, when they divided up the Ottoman Empire and created, quote-unquote, mandates to supposedly help the people become more developed and civilized, quote-unquote. So that Iraq petroleum pipeline from Kirkuk, which is in Kurdish territory, by the way, in Iraq, to Haifa was the goal of Netanyahu. Reopen it, let the oil flow, because it had been closed during the Israeli War for Independence in 1948. And, you know, Iraq was not going to send oil to this new state of Israel. So he wanted to reopen it. And they even had the plan for the person who was going to head up Iraq after Saddam Hussein was overthrown. And that was Ahmed Chalabi, an Iraqi who was living in exile, who was very pro-Israel. They had already sounded him out, and he was agreeable to reopening the oil spigot to Israel. And the only reason that didn't happen is because Chalabi was the person who came up with the weapons of mass destruction pretext for sending troops into Iraq, in which we later learned was a lie. There were no weapons of mass destruction. And that came out before...
Yeah, but everybody involved in the getting us to Iraq knew that, right?
Yeah, they knew it. And by the way, that's which brought great shame upon Judith Miller, the New York Times.
She
bought into it.
Well, she bought into it because she had a direct line into Cheney's office.
Yeah.
Char.
So,
I mean.
Yep. So.
I mean, she wanted. I think. Do you think she thought it was true?
I don't know. I can't say. I can't say that part, but she certainly got caught up in it. And it was a disgrace for the New York Times and for her and for Chalabi. There's no way they could put him in once that became known. And as you see, things are a mess over there. They thought that, here's the point, the big oil powers, and in this case, largely neoconservatives who were not, in my opinion, as sophisticated as the majors like ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, Chevron. All right, Chevron used to be Standard Oil of California, and which got the huge exclusive American concession in Saudi Arabia. And so there's a competition going on right now. The way I look at the Iraq war is that the junior players, independent oil companies and smaller oil companies, and we know that Bush was an oil man. As he once boasted, I know a lot about pipelines. And Cheney with Halliburton, that's become very major because it supplies the infrastructure to a lot of oil concerns. But at any rate, these guys were not on the level of, let us say, Rockefeller, which I happen to know quite a bit about because I wrote a whole book about how, with my husband Jerry Colby, about how Nelson Rockefeller built his empire in Latin America. And
that's an amazing book, by the way. It's called Thy Will Be Done.
Yeah, Thy Will Be Done. The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson Rockefeller, and Evangelism in the Age of Oil.
Yeah,
so
that's an amazing book, too.
And so when you go to the highest levels, which Jerry and I had to do to understand why genocide of Indians was going on in Latin America, we eventually, after about 4 years, we were able to solve that mystery. And learned that the people that were using missionaries were not nice church people. They gave donation to missionaries to save souls, to save Indian souls. And in Latin America, no, they were Eastern establishment oil companies and ranches and agribusiness, and top among them was Nelson Rockefeller. So having studied that, and in that book, we describe going to the highest level. And when you get to that level and then look down, everything makes sense. You see the whole web of connections and how they operate. And so having had that lesson, I was able to transfer it to the Middle East and saw a similar pattern, namely using indigenous groups and many of them, Islamist who were radicalized by the Saudis. And one of the interesting things that happened when I was in the Middle East, a lot of these countries were quite secular, and there was
Afghanistan was secular.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a fierce nationalism, okay?
Yes.
That was crushed.
Yes.
It was crushed.
Yes. Yes.
And what happened is, where do the people, who do they turn to? Who they ended up turning to were the fanatical jihadists, and
right.
who can be used, but sometimes it doesn't work. And as in the case of the Taliban, turning against the West. But it's these ugly proxy wars that are going on all over the Middle East. And they were used in Syria, most definitely. And they've been used not so much Yemen. In Yemen, the Houthi tribes have been fighting off the Saudis and the Americans. There's an oil connection to that, by the way, too. Trans-Yemen pipeline. Oh, my God.
And who's trying to defend that pipeline? Charlotte,
what?
Who's trying to do the Trans-Yemen pipeline? Who's in control of that?
Well, the Saudis want it.
Okay.
And you'll see in the book the map for that. The Saudis began to get concerned about what would happen if Iran blocked the Strait of Hormuz, through which, a great amount of world oil tankers go through.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And because of Iran's disputes with Saudi Arabia, the Saudis are thinking, man, we got to have an alternative route to send our oil just in case the Iranians close off the strait. So they figured out a route that would go through Yemen and go right down and sort of a north from Saudi Arabia south to a port on Yemen called Mukalla. And that is in the process of being built right now. One of the reasons they also did it is because they were worried about another choke point on the other side of Saudi Arabia. It's called the Bab al-Mandab. It's really interesting because of these two choke points geographically through which world shipping goes through. And so there has always been an effort to control them. And what scared the Saudis and the Americans is that these Houthi tribes people in the north began to rebel against the traditional ruler who was supported by the West. And they were able to overtake and get control of the capital of Yemen. And then they started moving south toward where Yemen oil fields are. So the concern was that they had to be fought on many levels. And the one thing that's interesting is that, Al-Qaeda has been used left and right by the West. And Al-Qaeda was used to protect the pipeline route in southern Yemen, where the pipeline is supposed to go through. That's just one example. So it's just so ugly, and the human suffering is so horrendous. We don't hear about Yemen anymore. Can you imagine what's going to happen? And I've been reading about it, about what's going to happen in Idlib in Syria, where these refugees are caught in Syria's final effort to rid Idlib of the Islamists, the jihadists, and causing massive human suffering in the process. And there's already concern about coronavirus getting into the refugee camps. There's concern about that happening in Gaza, too, which is already a humanitarian crisis writ large, as in Yemen. So here we are over here with our suffering. Well, what's going to happen to those people next?
This is on a whole other level.
Unconscionable.
So I just want to talk about, you were saying that the Israelis, you wrote that the Israelis have discovered oil in the Golan Heights, right? And
yes,
I thought there was also oil found off the coast of Gaza.
Yeah, that's right. Another story that's not told. It's well known over there, and it's even well reported. You know, I often read the Jerusalem Post and Haaretz, the two leading newspapers. I also read The Guardian. In other words, non-Western sources.
Non-American sources, you mean.
Yeah, non-American sources.
Well, also non-Western.
Al Jazeera, you know,
yeah.
I read that too. But, it's all well documented that there is a tremendous free-for-all, in a way, to control the vast amounts of natural gas that's been found off the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And so there have been conflicts between the Israelis and the Lebanese over a little slice of territory, offshore territory, where natural gas exists. And when the whole battle over Gaza, I found plenty of sources that show that what was really going on is that the Israelis did not want the Gazans to have access to oil right off the coast of the Gaza Strip, claiming...
Yeah, if the Palestinians had access to that, they'd have a little more money to live and defend themselves.
Well,
right?
That's right. Well, that's how the Palestinians looked at it, but the way the Israelis described it is that it would be used to support terrorism, so it absolutely cannot happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the game plan is to totally destroy Gaza. And the Gazans is like a prison.
It's like an open air prison. Yeah,
it's awful. And there's a lot of suffering there. When the gas was first discovered, Arafat was saying, "This is the answer. This is, I don't know, God's answer to our dreams. You know, that finally we would have some wealth of our own." And of course, now that looks like that's not going to happen. It's going to be fought every which way, and the pretext will be that terrorists are firing rockets into Israel, which sometimes there have been rockets fired in, some in self-defense, but others maybe not aggressively. And so
there's no comparison between what the Palestinians have to defend themselves with and what the Israelis have to defend themselves, and who's large and in charge in that
well,
dynamic.
Well, that's true. It's just, it's a tragedy because it's the people are caught. Oops, I got to just...
Oh, is that your phone?
The people are caught in it. You know, one thing I want people to understand is that the Arabs fighting the Jews, that's all divide and rule. It's been going on for decades. And it's...
Well, before all this oil stuff happened, they lived side by side in peace, didn't they, over there in Palestine?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So what I do I have a whole chapter on it, the hidden history of pipeline politics in Israel, and how I got into it was one of my first great breakthroughs in my investigation into my father's death was an article in the New York Times, March 2, 1947, and it was about the pipeline, the Trans-Arabian pipeline. But there was a map, and the map, by the way, has been reproduced. I mean, we revised it somewhat.
Reconfigured, yeah.
Anyway.
It's been censored.
Sorry?
It's been censored or
No. No, the map's there. It's just that getting reproduction rights from the New York Times on a map is very difficult.
Right.
So we recreated the map.
Okay.
And when I was looking at it originally, I was so focused on the Trans-Arabian Pipeline and what its route was that I really wasn't looking at the two other pipelines. And that was the Iraq Petroleum Pipeline that I described earlier in our conversation, and the one of them, which was British controlled, that terminated in Haifa. So when I started to think about that it was built in the mid 1930s, but then I thought, well, getting the oil of Iraq was quote unquote a first class war aim by the British. So obviously, when they were looking at the oil of Iraq, they had to figure out where were they going to ship the oil to. And they figured it would be Palestine. And so you look at the route of that pipeline and how it cuts through, I think it does cut through Jordan, and terminates in Palestine. And then I thought, how does this relate to the Balfour Declaration that was in 1917 and which promised a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And what you find out is that pipeline was very much on the minds of Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister of Great Britain, and the recipient of the so-called Balfour Declaration, which was a letter, and it was to Lord Rothschild, who was very much involved in the oil business, the Rothschild families. This connection is seldom told, but it's all documented in the book, and there have been some really good investigations by Israeli journalists that have gotten documents declassified. And so that now they're beginning to reveal that there is an oil connection to the creation of the State of Israel. And the whole concept was we're going to have Jews from Europe, European Jews, will be there to protect our interests. And there you go. The people, I mean, the highest level manipulations that are going on, and there's always a glossy humanitarian reason for giving conquering a territory. And, of course, the plight of the Jews was horrendous, absolutely.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, they were the first people who said no blood for oil were Jews in Palestine during World War II, because then they realized that they were being sacrificed for Saudi oil. Not enough of them were allowed to escape the Holocaust because the United States did not want to upset Ibn Saud. So once people get into this whole angle, they will see the huge tragedy of the people living there that have been set against each other, Arabs against Jews, Sunnis against Shia, Kurds against Syrians. I mean, it's ugly. And we got to get beyond it.
Well, exactly. And my question to you is, how do you see something like that happening? There are two things, because, you know, we don't have a lot of time left. We only have about 7 minutes left. There are two things that I would like you to address. I'd like you to address press coverage of this whole business and of the great game for oil. And I'd like you to address, what could be a way that the best outcome could occur and with a peaceful Middle to create a peaceful Middle East. I know those are two big questions.
Yeah, lots of big questions in this interview, Christina, which I would expect from you. With regard to press coverage, there's been terrible censorship all along. Why do people not know these oil connections? Because it's censored. I'll just give you an example, though, where there have been some breakthroughs. For instance, Rachel Maddow has done a book blowout, and it's mostly about the Russians and Ukraine, but it's pretty harsh on ExxonMobil and all of its maneuverings, more in, you know, trying to get the oil of the Arctic and its meddling in Ukraine and some of the stands. She leaves out the Middle East entirely. But the reason I raise her book is because my book and her book have been paired in a review in Ms. Magazine. So I've had to sort of look at her book very carefully. But my point is, she would not usually make these oil connections when she's in her seat at MSNBC as an anchor. Usually they just don't talk about it. But sometimes it seeps out. I mean, there's Trump talking about we're going to go in and get the oil of Syria. So the cat's out of the bag now. You know, the whole Khashoggi thing, Saudi Arabia's corruption. There is enormous corruption wherever you see oil, and it's gradually getting talked about because it's so out in the open, quite frankly. So for the longest time, I felt I couldn't write my book. There was no way it was going to get out. And finally, I felt like I have to write this, especially.
Well, the time, I think the timing is perfect. We've got about 30 seconds for you to say something about
outcome.
How to fix it.
What could be the best outcome? The best outcome is that people use this time to do some deep soul searching and read books, obviously. I know a lot's on their mind, but something, I just hope that something good comes out of this horrific coronavirus pandemic that we're all in. And one good point that was made, I think it was by Cuomo, it's what we do with this period that's important. What are we going to do? How are we going to come out? And can we come out creating a better world?
Thanks so much, Charlotte, for coming on. This was a great talk. You too.